This is Matthew Curtis, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. London's beer scene is made up of a complex tapestry of colourful folks. Like with any beer community, its people are what really makes it. And here in London, one of those people is journalist and beer writer Will Hawkes. Hawkes has written about beer since 2010 for mainstream publications such as The Independent, The Washington Post, and The Financial Times, as well as specialist beer mags like Beer Advocate and All About Beer. He's authored two books, including the City Beer Guide Craft Beer London, along with its accompanying app. And in 2013, he won the prestigious British Guild of Beer Writers Beer Writer of the Year Award. Will is also the brains behind London's original Craft Beer Week, London Beer City, which is now entering its fourth year this August. Full disclosure, I'm now involved with helping Will organise this year's event, and as is often the case, it was this involvement that made me realise that we should sit down and record a conversation together. As you'd expect, our conversation is typically London-centric, and we dig into topics such as the condition of Cask Ale, the recent opening of Camden Town Brewery's $40 million facility, and the recent acquisition of London Fields Brewery by Carlsberg and Brooklyn Brewery. This is beer writer and journalist Will Hawkes. Listen in. So, Will, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure, absolute pleasure.
So, some people listening will know who you are and what you do, but a lot of people, a lot of listeners, particularly in the US, might not know who you are. So, do you just want to tell me a little bit about who you are and how you got into beer writing?
Yeah, I'm a journalist primarily. I used to work for a British newspaper called The Independent, and I worked on the sports desk. Mm-hmm. And it was about 2010, and things were getting more and more exciting in the British beer scene, and I was a bit sick of sport, to be honest, because it's like a 12-month merry-go-round. The same stories come around every year, and it gets really, really dull. So I started writing about beer. I think the first piece was a piece for The Independent about the American brewers at the Great British Beer Festival that year.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what year that was?
2010.
Okay.
And that was popular. And then The Independent, I think, realised that beer made for popular online copy.
Yeah.
So I started writing a blog weekly for the most part, and that was really well received. So, and I just enjoyed it. You know, the world of beer was very optimistic. I think it still is, but then particularly in the UK, it's very optimistic, very exciting.
Yeah.
Lots of interesting things happening, but we also have the history of British brewing too. So there's all these different elements that made it really good fodder for writing about.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into it. I'd written a few bits and bobs about beer before then, but that was when I really, really took the plunge.
Yeah. 2010 was a really interesting time for British beer. That was kind of like a sort of origin point for a lot of, not just brewers, but people getting enthusiastic about beer. It's certainly the year I would say I was getting into craft beer. It's when I discovered Brewdog and the Colonel and yeah. Thornbridge and brewers like that. And were you finding yourself becoming an enthusiast as much as you were? Was that in addition to wanting to write about it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if you want to write about something, you have to have a passion for it. And I think at that time, London was a bit behind the rest of the country.
Yeah.
And Evan at the Colonel had started brewing late 2009, but it wasn't really till 2010 that people outside his own social scene really noticed him. And I wrote a few stories about the Colonel as well. I think I wrote a print story about the Colonel in 2010,
yeah,
which was the first time they'd been mentioned in the press. Uh-huh. And
that's pretty big scoop.
Yeah, well, I was pleased with it. I mean, yeah. You know, and people were excited to see it in print. So I think that was a big moment for beer in London. I think that was really, you know, you look back to Meantime, who came about in 1999, 2000, yeah. And some other stuff that happened since then. And that obviously had an influence. But I think the real start point for what's happening in London beer now was the Colonel and 2010.
Yeah. So before that, you mentioned that it, you know, London was a bit behind. What was it behind for you? Where in the country was the most progressive centre for beer?
I'm not sure it was a centre so much as some breweries who were pushing things along. And obviously Brewdog were a big one. And Thornbridge. I think yeah. Thornbridge, they're not forgotten now. They're still a very, very important brewery yeah. in the UK. But I think in terms of flavour, they set the standards. And I think subsequently, in terms of flavour and quality and consistency, they still set the standards, you know, for modern brewers yeah. in the UK, you know, and they brew across a variety of styles. I mean, obviously the hoppy, the IPAs, the pale ales are the most popular ones.
But you're quite partial to their Hellas, aren't you?
Yeah, Lucas. Yeah. I think it's really good. I think it, you know, for a non-Bavarian Hellas, it's probably the best one I've had. I think it's really, really good, very drinkable. But I like a lot of them. I mean, the Bayern, the Pilsner they made, which I don't think they're making anymore, that was really, really good too. So a lot of their different styles, they made a beer de garde that was excellent.
Yeah.
They've done all sorts.
You know, yeah, I mean, and then on the other side of the scale, they did The Serpent, didn't they, with Garrett Oliver and Tom Oliver. That, you know, 2 years in the making, probably no money in that as well. It's a bit of a vanity project, but it was, you know, it's a bit like, look, we can still produce the most stunning barrel-aged beer as well.
Yeah, and it was such an interesting project and a fun thing to do. And they did really well with the two sours,
yeah.
So they've done a huge amount of stuff, and I still think in their own way, they're the most impressive brewery in Britain.
So you left behind sports journalism. You studied journalism before going into it as a profession as well.
Well, I did a 3-month pre-entry course, which is quite typical in British journalism. So I did a course at a little town on the south coast of England called Hastings, where I learned shorthand and the law and various other aspects of reporting.
Yeah.
And then I worked for a local newspaper in Kent called the Kentish Times for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Where I completed my training and learned how to be a journalist, essentially, on, you know, whilst on the job, which was great. And I think that's the very traditional way into writing in Britain, and probably in the States too. I don't know quite how it works over there journalistically, but it's kind of died out now because a lot of those local papers have either closed or they don't employ very many journalists anymore. So it was a really valuable school for me in learning about journalism, learning about writing. And I'm, you know, although at the time it felt like a real trudge, I'm really glad I did it.
Yeah. So do you regret leaving sports journalism behind? Could that have been a lucrative field than beer journalism?
Yeah, possibly. I think at the time I was writing about cricket. My main job at The Independent was to edit other people's copies and write headlines, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we won't go into explaining what cricket is to all the American listeners.
But I wrote a lot about county cricket, and a couple of summers I had a column about county cricket, audition reports and stuff like that too. But I felt that the opportunities within cricket were probably getting fewer and fewer at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, without wishing to go into the complexities of what's happening with English cricket,
yeah.
I think, you know, the people who tend to report on it get the best jobs are people who've played cricket for England.
Yeah.
So if you haven't, you know, if your sporting skills never went further than being, you know, not very good at the age of 16, then your chances are limited. And I felt like beer was a much more open world in terms of, if you wanted to speak to someone, to interview them, to get a story, you could just ring them up. With cricket, and it's not as bad as football, but with cricket you'd have to ring a press officer and then they'd arrange for someone to call you.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd be sat there Saturday afternoon waiting for a cricketer to call you for 5 minutes for a, you know, not very revelatory chat, which is a frustrating way to do your job. So that was one of the, you know, there was a kind of a push and a pull with me going into beer.
Yeah.
And the push was, I didn't think the opportunities were going to be that great in cricket.
Yeah. So you wrote for The Independent, but you also write for several other mainstream news sources, including The Washington Post, The Financial Times, The Telegraph. But you also write for some specialist beer publications, such as Beer Advocate and All About Beer.
Hmm.
So first I want to ask, what are the challenges in presenting beer to a mainstream audience, the Washington Post reader, the FT reader? How do you dress beer for that audience that isn't an enthusiast?
Well, I think you have to think about how you view other interests. You know, if you're not interested in football, how do you see the world of football? What interests you in the world of football?
Yeah.
You know, I think when you're in the world of beer, and it's inevitable, it happens to everyone, is you become very, very interested in the detail and the different trends and whatever. You know, and that's very important. You need detail for any journalistic piece you're writing. But you have to remember that most people are not as into it as you are.
Yeah.
So there may be a greater theme you can bring out of it, or a quirky story that maybe coincides with something else that's going on. So I recently wrote a piece for the FT about a brewery that uses artificial intelligence to brew their beer.
Yeah.
So you have that other aspect
Which brewery was that?
It's a brewery in Bermondsey.
Okay.
They actually brew at U-Brew.
Yeah.
So they don't brew very much, and most of the beer is distributed within that AI community in East London.
Okay.
But it's an interesting way of doing things.
There's an AI community?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, it's quite big. I mean, in London, that London is, you know, one of the places that's really leading the way with that stuff. So it's kind of an interesting thing for it to have happened in London and kind of natural that it happened in London.
That's fascinating. Yeah. For those listening that don't know what Ubrew is, it's sort of a collective of small breweries. It's a company that basically you pay a subscription and you can go and brew beer. And some of the hobbyists are turning those into professional breweries.
Yeah,
they have
absolutely.
A five-barrel kit as well as small 100-litre kits you can use. So that's spawning sort of a new generation of brewers. But that's fascinating that there's an AI brewery. That is very East London, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And I think it's an interesting idea. I mean, I think the thing about AI is...
Yeah.
This is actually quite a small idea. You know, you drink the beer, you answer 10 questions. They use that information to evolve the beer. But actually, on a bigger scale, when you think about, you know, all the preferences that we have, you know, it's a bit frightening. It's a bit 1984. But there are different ways in which our personal experiences could be honed and improved to deliver a more, you know, it sounds like marketing speak now, but deliver a more enjoyable experience.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. Did you get to try the beer?
I did try the beer.
Was it any good?
Yeah, it was decent beer. You know, it wasn't the best beer I've ever had, and it wasn't the worst. I think it's an interesting concept, but actually, what the project has shown is that if you produce a beer like this, you end up with the kind of beer that you'd produce anyway. You know, the pale ale was an American hopped 4% session IPA kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know, and you don't have to be a tech whiz kid to know that's what people want to drink at the moment. So,
It's interesting. Like the 4% pale and hoppy, I'm almost sick of it. So I'm not sick of it because I probably drink more of it than other beers, but I find that, I want to talk about how the beer industry has changed since say 2010 in London. But I find there's a lot of great bars now that maybe have 10, 15, 20 taps and they'll have one or two lagers always. Then I'll have 18 other beers that will pretty much all be pale and hoppy within a sort of 4 to maybe 5.5-6% bracket. Do you think, you know, obviously craft beer is about choice, but do you think actually because of consumer preference, is that choice being stifled? I mean, I would, you know, I go to some great bars in America and they'll have ambers and stouts and saisons. It'll be a very diverse tap list, but I'm not seeing that in not just London, but the UK as a whole. It seems to be pale and hoppy. Do you think this is a problem?
I don't think it's a problem. I think it's the stage that we're at. I think it's a sign of London's immaturity. You know, I think people are very excited about those hoppy beers and quite rightly because they're delicious.
Yeah.
But, you know, to choose one example, I've just written a story for Beer Advocate about London Porter and loads of London brewers are making porters and lots of them are really, really good. You know, some of the best beers brewed in London.
Fuller's London Porter.
Well, that's the classic. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, as I've discovered recently, you know, the vast majority of Fuller's London Porter is exported.
Yeah.
Because it's much easier to sell it in the States or Scandinavia or Russia than it is to sell it
in
the UK.
And you said Italy as well has a huge market for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are overseas have a better understanding of the significance of London Porter to the history of brewing and to British brewing than people in London maybe do. So I think, you know, at some stage, I'm sure we'll get there in maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years. People will have a broader appreciation of all the different types of beer. But at the moment, you know, that hoppy flavour is driving interest without a doubt.
Definitely. So how do you think that the London beer scene has evolved since you started writing about beer in 2010? How far have we come? Is it what you expected?
I think we've come a long way. In some ways, it's what I've expected. In some ways, it isn't.
You talked about an immaturity. Do you think we're starting to mature a little?
I think the way that London beer is maturing is that the quality of beer produced in London is far, far better than it used to be.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I think that's the result of competition.
Yeah.
You know, when one brewery raises the standards and the others all have to respond, you know, I think you see some really, really good beer being made in London now.
Yeah.
And compared to 2, 3 years ago, it's a different world. I think there is an immaturity, as I said. But I think what you have to acknowledge with beer, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying about writing for major publications, is that there are always new people coming into it. There are always people for who it's new. And the hook for them is often those, you know, those incredible flavours you get from New World hops.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's people who have been into beer their entire lives. There's people who started really loving it in 2010. And there are people who it's new to now.
Yeah.
And there are also people for whom this is the biggest chunk of the market, for whom it will never be a big thing, but who just like a nice glass of beer.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the key thing that's happened in London, particularly in East London, to a lesser extent, East London, North London, South London, less extent, West London, is that quite ordinary pubs now have a better beer offering than they used to have.
Yeah, fantastic. You've written a couple of books as well as writing for those magazines and papers I said earlier. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the books you've written?
Yeah, sure. Well, the first book I wrote, 2012, was Craft Beer London. And that was kind of a reflection of where beer was at that moment in time, and it was the 25 best pubs, the best breweries, a few features about the scene. So it was kind of like a little memento of where beer was.
Yeah, and that was part of an app as well, wasn't it? I've got an app
called Craft Beer London, which is a guide to London beer. And actually, Craft Beer London is a good way of sort of demonstrating how beer has changed in the city.
Yeah.
Because 2012, 2013, 2014, it was very easy for me to keep up all the places that should be on the app. And I feel like now we're almost at the stage where an app like Craft Beer London no longer has a place, because if you walk around large swathes of the city, you could just drop into a pub and you know there'll be a decent beer on the bar.
There'll be Gamma Ray. It's funny you say that, because I used to use the app a lot, and now I know that there's sort of five or six craft beer places where I go, and I know it's craft, but there are... You know, pubs are catching up. I mean, there's a great example, the pub at the end of the street here, the Great Northern Railway Tavern. Mm. Fuller's bought that about a year ago, and then they closed it 6 months ago for this huge refurb, and they put 21 taps in it, and it's has 8 Fuller's beers on keg, 4 on cask, and then a further, 15, so 21 taps altogether.
Yeah,
it's early in the morning. My maths aren't great anyway.
Not enough coffee.
What I mean is that it's just a normal pub, but they have, I mean, they were putting on some Lervig tasty juice, like New England IPA, a pub at the end of the street, and that's becoming kind of a normality, which is a great thing.
Yeah.
But then how does a conscientiously craft venue define itself? Are they going to have to redefine themselves now?
I guess so. I think there are places like Mother Kelly's or Mason & Co., which are very specialist beer outlets.
Yeah.
But I think they'll always be in the minority, you know, and I think your corner boozer, you know, I think if I had to choose a sort of perfect lineup, you'd have 2 or 3 cask ales in peak condition, and then you maybe 6 to 8 keg beers across a variety of styles. You know, I don't think you need more than... You know, I mean, you could have one beer if it was fantastic. I mean, yeah, if you go to Germany, parts of Germany or the Czech Republic, that's often the case.
Yeah.
But if you have 12 beers and you have a good variety and they're all kept well, then that's really all you need.
Yeah, less is more. I agree with that. But do you think we'll see, you know, I think the biggest tap wall in London is still about 43. It's Brewdog Shepherd's Bush.
Mm.
And no one's come in. That opened about 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
No one's come in and done that. But yet you go to any US city and you'll see 100 or more taps.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll ever see that kind of culture develop in the UK? Or do we just not drink enough beer?
I don't know. It may be an interesting cultural difference between the US and the UK. You know, there's always been a part of US culture which has been, let's make it bigger, let's make it bigger, let's make it bigger.
Yeah.
And I don't think we necessarily have that same inclination. It may happen. It may be just, you know, we're 5-10 years away from that.
Yeah.
Or it may be that we're just... not interested in 100 taps.
Yeah, it would. It's almost. I often find myself going to when I'm in Fort Collins. There's a great bar with 100 taps called the Mayor of Old Town, and I will find myself sticking to 2 or 3 beers. You know, it's amazing to see 100 beers, but there's only one, two, three. I really want to drink, but I guess that's the beauty of it as well, because you know everyone tastes differently and wants something different out of their beer experience.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. But I think another thing to remember is London just has so many pubs and bars compacted into a different area. So if you think about the volume of taps in London, as well as, you know, handfuls as well,
yeah,
that's a massive amount of beer.
And we always forget, I mean, London is you know, putting the issue of beer to one side for a second, it's one of the world's great drinking cities.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a fantastic place to drink too much. It really is.
I've done that many times, I can confirm. So, coming out of the Craft Beer London app, you started 4 years ago something called London Beer City, which this year I'm helping you run. And what was that, a natural progression to decide to start what is essentially a London's Beer Week?
I don't know. I was thinking about this on the way over, like, you know, why did I decide to do that? And there wasn't really any philosophy behind it. Kind of almost happened by accident. I was talking to a lot of people about a London Beer Week and whether we should have one, because I knew about Philadelphia and Melbourne and how successful they'd been there. And
you've been to Philly Beer Week and Good Beer
Week, Good Beer Week in Melbourne, and been impressed with both of them. And actually the people who run Philly when I was just starting London Beer City were really helpful.
Yeah.
You know, chatting about it and various different, you know, elements and pitfalls. So they had a real influence on me.
Yeah.
And in the end, I decided just to do it not entirely on my own, because John Crine at the London Brewers Alliance and Paddy from Windsor and Eaton Brewery were both very keen to get it on the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, you know, a city like London, which has an almost unique combination of incredible brewing history plus this new blooming of interest in beer, deserve this sort of thing. And I think with the Great British Beer Festival in August, the London Craft Beer Festival in the same week, if you had some beer events built around those two massive festivals, you could create an unbelievable beer week. So that was always my vision, and I think we're still working towards that, but we're getting closer.
Definitely. And I think a lot of that comes with how, you know, you started it in what would it have been, 2014, and you know you talk about how much the London beer scene has changed in that short period of time. It's pulling a lot more people in.
Yeah,
you know, you talk about the interest in your articles in the mainstream press. But you know, do you ever see London Beer City becoming like a, you know, Philly Beer Week is pretty magical. Do you ever see it having that kind of gravitas, or do you hope?
I would hope it would. I mean, I think the thing about London Beer City, and I think this is true of Philly, actually.
Yeah.
But London Beer City is a real sort of grassroots thing.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't huge money coming in from above. There isn't any, you know, macro investment in it, really. It's just, it stands and falls on how engaged London breweries, London pubs get in it. And that's been its success when it's been successful, is that people have really worked hard to make it work. So, yeah, I would love it to be bigger and bigger and bigger, but it's really a very gradual process. It's not going to be an overnight, you know, phenomenon.
Definitely. It's interesting that you picked the week of GBBF. Obviously, that same week, we now have the London Craft Beer Festival, which is about the same, about maybe 5 years old.
Yeah,
maybe
five this year.
Yeah, a year longer. But GBBF, you know, it's an institution, and it pulls so many people in from all over the world. You know, the Brewers Association come over from the United States. And people come up from all over the UK, from Europe, to visit this. How do you make... I think it's a great idea, because you've got all these people in the city, but how do you get those people who are here for GBBF, or maybe the London Craft Beer Festival now, how do you get them to pick up a programme and start getting out to these events? How do you reach them, basically?
Well, I mean, it's like I said with the grassroots thing. I mean, I don't have a massive PR budget. I can't afford to spend £20,000 on, you know, hassling media institutions. So, to a certain extent, it's social media. You know, it's doing stuff like this. It's just trying to get the word out in the most affordable way possible, so I don't bankrupt myself and destroy my marriage.
And what do you think it is about, you know, we mentioned Philly and we mentioned Good Beer Week Melbourne. What is it, you know, they're great beer weeks. What is it about them that makes them so special?
I think it's slightly different. I think Philadelphia is a great drinking town.
Yeah, I can wholeheartedly agree with you on that.
And it has that down-to-earth beer drinking culture.
Yes.
And that's what Philly Beer Week is built on. I think Melbourne also has an aspect of that, but Melbourne is one of the world's great gastronomic cities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the standard of food in Melbourne You look at the coffee in Melbourne, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and wine as well. Wine, yeah.
Exactly. So it's got all those aspects, you know, and beer fits in very nicely with that.
Yeah.
So they're kind of slightly different, but the end result is the same. You have a great festival of beer.
Good Beer Hunting is made possible by the financial contributions of our underwriters. Our Fervent Few community, a growing community of GBH fans, including some professionals like Hops and Grain in Austin, Texas, and Cloudwater Brewco in Manchester, UK, support us through their monthly subscriptions. And Guinness, our first major underwriter, helping us bring you a new series of stories called Coming to America, featuring upstart and iconic breweries from around the world who are trying to make their way in the US in the age of local. As part of the Guinness Coming to America section, we'll be featuring new wave breweries, as well as long-standing imports like this month's focus on the history of Pilsner Urquell, which first started pouring in the US in 1870s in Racine, Wisconsin. We're thrilled to be digging into these stories, and like this podcast and many of our other projects, Coming to America wouldn't be possible without our underwriting support from companies like Guinness. Watch for more underwriters and new themes like Coming to America in the coming months. The UK now has, I call it a spate of beer weeks now. You've got Leeds Beer Week, Manchester, Sheffield, Bristol. And then we've got Norwich, which had the UK's original beer week in City of Ale. Yeah. It now has a second beer week because City of Ale celebrates cask, but not keg beer. So someone has started Norwich Craft Beer Week. How can a small island like the UK sustain so much activity?
I think people in Britain are very proud of where they come from. And I think this is true everywhere, but in Britain particularly so.
Yes.
It's a very tribal country.
Yes.
You know, you see this in beer all the time. You know, southern beer is rubbish. Oh, northern beer is rubbish. You know, people are, you know, it's almost like having a row for the sake of it. You know,
I've had a few of those
and
myself.
That's a particularly a British trait. So if you're from Leeds, you know, you think, well, Leeds is the best beer city in the UK. If Manchester's going to have beer week, if London's going to have a beer week, we're going to have one too. And people in Bristol and Manchester and, you know, all over have the same feeling about the locality. And I think it's great they're all different beer weeks. And I'd like to, we've had discussions about it, but I'd like to have more collaboration between them because I think it's, it can only be good.
I agree. You know, I think reaching out to these cities. I mean, but we've got some hubs, haven't we? We've got beer from Leeds and Yorkshire and Manchester and
the West Country.
Kent and Sussex. Yeah, we've got, you know, not just that, we've got a Scandinavian
bar.
So yeah, I think I agree with that. I think something I would like to see is, something I'm seeing is beer is spreading out from the metropolitan areas. Mm. This year has been the big year of these smaller towns getting craft beer spots. I mean, I went to Tunbridge Wells recently, Fuggles Beer Cafe. It's one of the best bars in the country, surely. The Beer Boutique, great little craft beer shop and tap room. And it's just in this smaller town. I went to Hereford, to the Hereford Beer House. Again, a small town. They've also got Odyssey Brewing, who are making New England IPA in this small town. Yeah. So it's definitely the year of craft. Maybe this will be what actually starts bringing it together, because we're these distant little islands within an island, right? We've got London, Manchester, Leeds, and everyone always talks about these cities. But then if you've got sort of in between, you've got, you know, Daya Brewing in Cheltenham or the Hereford Beer House or these little in-betweens, it's maybe starts that interconnectivity.
I think so. I think ideas spread out from the major metropolises anyway. Yeah. But I think also what's happening, and this is maybe particularly a London thing, is London's very expensive. I mean, you know that.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
And I was down in Margate recently, which is a seaside town in Kent, which for a long time has had some serious social
problems.
That's got
some great bars now.
Exactly. And now, but one of the reasons for that is that loads of people from London have moved down there.
Yeah.
So when people come out from the cities, whether it be London, Manchester, whatever, you know, small towns, they're like, well, you know, I love the pace of life. This is why I chose.
Yeah.
This is why I chose to move here. But I'd still like to have some of the great stuff that
the
I enjoyed in the city.
Of home, you know,
and that includes great beer.
Yeah. Fantastic. We have seen a little bit of animosity this year. When Beavertown announced their extravaganza festival, it happened to be due to the constraints of the venue on the same weekend as the Leeds International Beer Festival. Do you expect more circumstances to arise like this where people might not be happy with the event clash? Or do you think as the scene matures, they'll be able to work and move through it?
I think the remarkable thing is that beer has been so amicable for so long. You know, I think while everyone was growing, and lots of people still are growing,
yeah,
you know, and there was huge amount of space in the market, you know, there was the illusion that it was a collective effort,
yeah,
you know, and to a certain extent it was. People felt like they were part of a, you know, something exciting, yeah, that was happening,
and for a lot of it still very much is. You know, it's rarely you'll not walk into a bar in an evening and you'll see someone from a brewery or a, yeah, bar, and you know, it's pretty convivial.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And but I think as breweries, the bigger breweries get bigger and bigger, there will be more friction. That's natural, and I don't think it's unhealthy. You know, and whether that happens in terms of when an event is taking place, or you know, when two breweries are competing for bar space,
yeah,
it's a natural part of how, you know, the capitalist system works.
Definitely. And London, I feel like London has everywhere does, but London has its share of detractors. And there's a few things I've seen recently. I mean, you get people who visit from the north who tell us maybe our cask ale's too warm and not in good quality. The price is a big thing, but I think, you know, the cost of living in London, the cost of running a business in London is very expensive. But people still, they know that, but they still find time to complain about it. And people also complain about the service, you know. And the other thing I'm seeing is people saying that London's cutting-edge breweries aren't keeping pace, yeah, with the rest of the country. And this could be as simple as because they're not putting it in big cans, because that's the hallmark of cutting-edge. Like, how do you feel that there's a perception that London might not be keeping pace with, say, Manchester or Leeds?
I think there's a number of different things happening, yeah, here. Like, some of it is just silliness. You know, when you talk, yes, about cans, I mean, that's
yeah,
just
this
like,
is beer.
You know, that's silly. I think for a long time, some pubs in London have not looked after cask ale well enough. We, yes, all know that.
Yeah.
You there are some pubs you go and you get a pint of cask ale. Think, why are you bothering serving it? Just stick to keg beer.
Yes, Pete Brown's been pretty vocal about this as well, hasn't he, in a few columns recently.
Yeah, and I think that's probably, I mean, it happens all over the country. It's not just London.
Yeah.
You know, there are publicans all over the country who are not doing a good job by cask ale, but it's probably, without having done any, you know, particular research into it other than drinking in pubs, it's probably more prevalent in London.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that happens a lot is that people like a stick to beat London with, you,
yeah,
know, because London is successful. It's one of the world's, you know, cultural powerhouses, you know, and, you know, if people can say, you know, such and such is bad about London, it makes them feel a bit better. You know, I let it wash over me, to be honest. I know I live here. I know what London's flaws, yeah, are. I know what its benefits are, you know. So, yeah, I don't need to be told by someone who lives in
Yorkshire. So what are a couple of its flaws?
I think, away from the world of beer, the big flaw is housing.
Yes,
you know, we haven't got enough affordable housing for young people. You know, that is the London's most serious issue.
It is, yes.
And you know, we've seen recently, you know, some of the housing problems we've got in London. So that's, you know, that's away from beer.
Yeah.
I think in terms of beer, probably the cask ale is the big one.
Yeah.
There are some great, great places in London to drink cask ale.
Yeah, there really are.
But I sometimes wish,
in the minority, I would say.
I think they're in the minority, yeah. And I sometimes wish, if there was one benefit of what's happening with beer, it would be that pubs would have the confidence to say, actually, it's too difficult for us to serve cask ale in the right condition.
Yeah.
We're just going to serve great keg beer.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the results of the way British beer evolved from the 70s onwards was that cask ale became the only good beer, the serious,
yes, yeah,
beer. And if you didn't have cask ale, you weren't doing beer right.
Yeah.
You know, and if we can get to a situation where you can get, you know, and you can now, but where people feel like you can get great, great beer from a keg.
Yeah.
You know, and if you do have space issues or other problems, you can just serve keg beer rather than cask beer, you know, and still, yeah, have a great, successful pub.
It's great that you mentioned that, because there's two great keg-only bars,
yeah,
in Mason & Company and Mother Kelly's.
Yeah.
Who the only, you know, people have said, oh, why don't you sell cask beer? And the only reason they don't is because they've, when they fit the space out, they went, we're not going to be able to do a good enough job. Yeah. So they made a conscious decision. If we can't do it right, we're not going to do it at all. And I think there's a lot, there's probably a lot more bars with sellers that aren't up to cask beer that, that haven't been able to make that decision, because you're right. It's this hangover of the, you know, the almost camera infused mentality that the hand pulls on the bar are a sign yeah. that a pub cares about its beer.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
now isn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, although there's a bar, the Italian Job, that has a hand pull on the bar, but it's a key keg beer.
Yes, well, that's like Moda Lambic, isn't it? People yeah. say, oh, I'm drinking cask Lambics. Well, actually, it's a key keg
yeah,
hooked
yeah.
up to a beer yeah. engine. But, so we've talked about some of the negatives. What are some of the positives? And where do you like to go and get a good pint of cask beer in London?
Well, I mean, the classics, the Harp.
And, yes,
and
the Harp.
The White Horse in Parsons Green.
Yes.
I don't recall ever having had a bad pint of cask ale in either of those.
Yeah.
And it's always in beautiful condition.
The Harp is actually, whenever someone visits London, especially from the States, that's the first place I send them now.
Yeah.
It's like, go and get a pint of either Hophead or Harvey's Best.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on whether you want something lighter, a bit darker. And it's because you can be confident, you know, that the cask is always... super
top knit, yeah. Yeah, and closer to me where I live is a pub called the Blythe Hill Tavern,
okay,
which is a you know, old school pub, Irish pub, and they have Harvey's always in fantastic nick.
Yeah, yeah. I can't get enough of that beer at the moment as well. It's kind of like being my, whereas like a few years ago when I, you know, you went go through your craft phase as a young drinker, everything's pale, hoppy, wonderful, and then I had this some unfiltered Pilsner Urquell about 5 years ago, and made me go, oh, actually, lager's still brilliant. What have I been saying to myself? And it was Harvey's Best that made me go, oh, bitter.
Yeah.
And my, like, and then their mild, I was talking about their mild just yesterday. It's like, people are into that mild because there aren't very many good ones, but if you could get Harvey's mild everywhere, people would be like, oh, this is actually...
yeah, yeah.
It's great.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what a bar... your cask hotspots. What else is great about London's beer scene at the moment?
I think going back to the fact that good beer is increasingly prevalent in places where you just wouldn't find it anymore. You know, I think the important thing about beer and what's happening now is it's becoming easier to access for ordinary people. It's not just a geek thing. You know,
yeah.
You go into fairly ordinary places or even just your corner shop and suddenly, you know, most corner shops now have like got BrewDog in them at the very least.
Yeah, well...
so, you know, that aspect of it is becoming...
I'll tell you something. I was in Paris last week and every corner shop had BrewDog in it. It was... I didn't expect to see that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know... and Paris is interesting because it has its own peculiarities. But
yes.
It's kind of where London was 3 or 4 years ago and the same enthusiasm and... you know, young, lots of young men in their early 30s were very earnest about beer.
Yes, you know? Definitely. I was in Paris last week and, you know, I sort of, I thought probably optimistically that because of how London's become in the last couple of years with beer being so prevalent, I might have experienced that in Paris. But if you wanted to seek out craft beer, you really had to seek it out. And that reminded me what it was like in London 5 years ago. And, you know, just sitting in a bar and you can get Kronenbourg or Heineken or Carlsberg.
Yeah. Ridiculously expensive.
And it's hideously expensive, yeah, isn't yeah. it? I mean, that's partly because we get a terrible exchange rate.
It's partly that, but it's always been expensive.
Yeah.
There are two distributors who basically control most of the taps in Paris.
Yeah.
And they put in the taps and they dictate what prices... is charged for the beer, so you get really crap beer for unbelievably high prices, which is why you should mostly drink wine in Paris.
Yes, yeah. I went to some fantastic beer spots there. La Fin Mousse,
yeah.
It's superb. But Le Trois Huit around the corner from there, which
yeah.
is a little small rock bar with 10 taps.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a great time in there.
There are some cool things happening. Like there's a place in the, I think it's in the 19th arrondissement called El Tast, where they've got unbelievably good quality Spanish charcuterie, and they pair that with local Parisian and
yeah.
Ile-de-France craft beers.
Yeah.
So there's some really cool stuff happening, and of course France does have that sophisticated food culture.
You
know, it's starting
so.
To blend in and produce some interesting and unique results.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely like in terms of craft beer, feels like an emerging market. Really, feels like London.
Yeah.
You know, 5-7 years ago,
they've got. I was speaking to. Simon Tillou, who's the owner of Cave à Bull, which is basically like the, you know...
Typically it was closed when I went to go there.
Yeah.
Like things two or three of the places I tried to go to were.
But you know, I think they've got over 1,000 breweries in France. They're mostly quite small.
Yeah.
But they've all opened in the last decade, by and large.
So coming back to London Beer City, what can we expect from this year's event? It starts on, it's the 3rd of August.
3rd to the 13th of August, yeah. So we've got an opening event at Mason & Co. We have the best beer from around Britain.
Yeah.
Obviously the London Craft Beer Festival is on that first weekend. More than 45 breweries, lots from Britain, but also around Europe and from across the Atlantic.
The US as well. They've got other half are coming from New York. That's huge.
Yeah,
Modern Times from San Diego as well.
Yeah. It'll be a tremendous event. Great food as well this year. Really great food and music. So that's always good fun.
Yeah.
Next week, I mean, we've got huge diversity. You know, you're involved in the Marble event at
Jigshead,
which will be superb.
It'll be a riot, yeah.
Yeah, we've got beer from the States, beer from New Zealand, Australia, Scandinavia, loads of beer from London, around the UK.
Yeah.
If you like beer, there will be something for you.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, are you... what advice would you give to someone who is going into it and is going to try and do as much as possible?
I think, you know, just don't drink too much in one in one sitting, because there's a lot of fun stuff to do, you know. But if you you go too hard too early, then you won't get to do a lot of that fun stuff.
Yeah, and we can't forget GBBF as well. I mean,
absolutely.
I've had a bit of a love hate relationship with GBBF, because before I worked in the beer industry, I would go there with an open mind, just drink whatever came to me. Never made a list, and I would have the best time, drink too much, brilliant. And then when I went in with an analytical mind, I started to enjoy it less and less, especially when I just hung around by the US imports, because the Brewers Association send over casks from American brewers, but they're usually not great because they don't get a chance to condition properly. These brewers aren't used to putting beer in cask, but still that's what draws the crowd. But last year I said, right, I went and tried one beer that I was quite interested in over there. But then I got back into the classics and back into some small British breweries. Like Abbeydale was one. I had a beer from them. It was fantastic. I had some Batham's Bitter, because you don't see that in London.
Yeah.
It's fantastic beer. So I think my relationship, I'm back. Like, you need to remember to almost switch off your brain at GBBF and just enjoy yourself.
It is about cask ale.
Yes.
You know, and it's a chance to try cask ales that you wouldn't normally get the chance to try wherever you live in the UK. You know, beer travels a lot more now than it used to, but there are still some beers that are hard to come by, even in London. So, and I think they've made huge leaps in terms of the quality of how the beer is served at GBBF as well. So, yeah, I go generally... mostly for cask ale, but also they have some great beer from Germany, Czech Republic, Italy, you know, the States.
Yeah,
so
they get some mad stuff from the Netherlands, don't they? Like barrel aged De Molen and stuff.
They've always got Cantillon on tap at some stage as well. So yeah, there's always interesting things. Some of the Czech Pilsens are fantastic.
Yeah.
Franconian get some killer beers, and you know, so there is loads of great beer, and I think it's just a fun occasion. You know, if you see it as a massive pub rather than like a, you know, like a more sort of beery festival, then that's the best way to enjoy it.
Definitely. Okay, let's talk about a little bit of industry stuff, because there's so much happening in London at the moment. For starters, Camden's £30 million brewery in Enfield is now open. It's huge. It's got something like a 200,000 hectolitre capacity.
Yeah.
And they've got the space to double it, which is the plan, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
That's open now. It's been brewing for over a month. How's that going to change the UK beer landscape?
Well, I think Camden will be like BrewDog. That their beer will be absolutely...
BrewDog won't like to hear that.
No, but I mean, you know, I mean, BrewDog have taken a slightly different route.
Yeah.
But essentially, the end result is, you know, BrewDog still have more control over their beer because James Watt still has a big stake in the company.
Yeah.
Whereas Jasper Kupiec, the founder of Camden, is now at the behest of AB InBev.
Yes.
But I think as long as the company's doing well, and you know, whatever you say about it, it's always been it's always been well run in terms of producing a decent product. You know, as long as that product is successful in the market and continues to be popular, I don't think InBev are gonna mess with it too much. So I think we'll see it. You know, I think in London we've already seen it for a few years. It's Camden against Meantime, and they've been really battling for tap space. You know, and they were kind of the advanced guard of taking decent beer into keg beer into pubs where it hadn't been before. I think Camden. You know, I think Camden, because of the name, probably has an unexplored market outside of the UK.
Yes.
You know,
definitely.
Certainly in across the channel and whatever. So I think, you know, Jasper works extraordinarily hard. He's one of the hardest working men in London
beer.
Yes, very
much
so. I think that'll be a big success. And he's still keen. I think he's still keen to be part of London beer, but it's obviously difficult because people are suspicious of AB InBev and with good reason sometimes. So yeah, we'll see how that plays out.
Definitely. And there's more buyout news this week, quite a big bit of news. So Carlsberg UK and Brooklyn entered into a partnership with this, what will be their fourth brewery they've bought together. They bought London Fields. Now, London Fields have a bit of a checkered history. It was its founder, Jules Devere Whiteway Wilkinson, try and get that right. He did time for drug dealing, and he embezzled a lot of. He wasn't paying his tax.
Yeah,
and he was also brewing without a license. And there's not a lot of positive feeling within the London beer industry for him, or for indeed the London Fields brand. And yet, Brooklyn have come out and said they are happy to buy what they see as an iconic London brand. I mean, London Fields, it's got a great name. You know, how do you feel about this?
Well, it's interesting.
I know how I feel about
it. It's interesting because, like anyone in London beer, I've had a few encounters with Jules. Mm. When I was first pitching London Beer City to the LBA, London yes. Brewers Alliance, he turned up at the meeting and asked a series of what seemed to me to be fairly asinine and unhelpful questions. And then at the end, he came up and was all smiles and backslapping and was, you know, if you want me to help you out in any way.
Yeah.
So that was a slightly odd. And then he hosted this festival a few years ago. It was called London's Brewing.
Yes. Yeah. We all have memories of that.
And it was a complete disaster. I was supposed to be doing a talk at the event.
Yeah.
I'd rather naively agree to do that. And I got there and like half the equipment wasn't working. There were supposed to be two or three different rooms, and there was one room with a stage at the end, and the room was just full of angry beer drinkers who didn't have a beer.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to stand. I thought, you know, there's absolutely no chance, not happening.
Yeah.
So we all decamped to the Cock Tavern down the road.
Yeah.
So I think that's what really pissed a lot of people off, because he took a lot. I mean, that was a lot of investment from the London Brewers Alliance in that event.
Yes, yeah.
And it didn't go well, to put it very mildly.
No.
So he's an interesting character, and in London, among the beer community, London Fields is not a great brand, is
no.
it? I mean, it's been hugely devalued by how the brewery's been run no. and all the things that have happened. But I think someone made an astute point, is that maybe, you know, when Carlsberg and Brooklyn are looking at London Fields, they're not really looking at London. They're looking at the name of the brewery and how it can sell outside of London, because London is, in Europe in particular, it's a huge brand.
It's interesting that some people have been thinking, oh, Brooklyn are going to brew Brooklyn Lager there, which isn't the case. I mean, from what I understand it, they're going to follow the path of, say, New Carnegie. New Carnegie, which was in Sweden, was a dead brand, pretty much. It was a old school brewery that no one's buying their beer, and they invested in that and built that from the ground up. And they've done the same with EC Dahls. And last week they also bought a brewery in Hong Kong. But some of Brooklyn's comments about it being an iconic brand, I personally found were a bit lacking insight.
Yeah.
But do you think they will be able to, you know, move past this ill feeling, you know, because, you know, London Fields, they were kicked out of SIBA, they were kicked off the London Brewers Alliance.
Mm.
You know, there's very little positive will towards them in the brewing industry, particularly in London. But do you think that the mainstream beer audience will, you know, will they care?
I think they probably won't care.
Yeah.
I think it's important to remember the people who know about this stuff. And actually, a lot of the the tax stuff and the drug dealing stuff was in the Evening Standard, which is like the big London newspaper.
Yes.
So there is a wider audience for that sort of stuff, but they might not necessarily put two and two together and connect it with, you know, this London Fields brand.
Yeah.
So I think for most people, particularly outside of London, it won't be an issue. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I think most people in the London beer scene were just kind of a bit baffled and just found it funny because it's such an unlikely acquisition, and it could turn out to be a masterstroke. But you know, we thought that brand was basically gone. It was kind of, you know, on life support.
Because of his, he's in court next week for the tax thing. But the brewery was up for sale for $1 million. That some reports say it was $4 million was the actual figure, and they're getting the brand and this space, which is an event space, a bar space for the brewery. So it's, you know, it's a pretty good brewery. But for Carlsberg, this is key because out of all the big lager brands, none feel like they're losing more relevance than Carlsberg at the moment, particularly in the UK. Like, you know, it's not a great beer. It's not got any... Well, it has got a lot of great heritage.
Yeah,
amazing heritage.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not a beer like Urquell, right?
No.
But for them, like, being involved with Brooklyn's huge for them. That gives them a bit of credibility. They distribute Brooklyn everywhere. It's, you know, Brooklyn Lager is everywhere. We'll come on to that a bit more in a moment. But do you think this is going to help Carlsberg pull back some credibility within the British market?
I don't know. I'm not even sure they're that interested in credibility. I mean, the thing interesting about Carlsberg is it's not a huge conglomerate. There's still that family influence in how it's run and how it's... And in Denmark, they do have a real...
Almost like Coors in the US in a way.
Yeah, I don't know much about Coors, but Carlsberg, they do have a social aspect to what they do, you know, and they... I don't know that Danes necessarily are affectionate towards him, but it probably is a slightly different perception to how we have it in the UK.
In the UK it's the cheap beer you drink at beer festivals because they sponsor them and you can't drink anything else.
Yeah, or Tuborg, which is their other brand.
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know. I it's a really interesting move, and will it be successful? Possibly. It's a growing market, you know, and if they produce, as you know, consistency is Carlsberg's kind of watchword.
Yeah.
You know, if they have some of BrewDog's Brooklyn's brewing nouse and Carlsberg's investment and commitment to consistency, they could make some very nice beers, put them out under the London Fields brand, and they may well be a big success.
Yeah, well, that we see. So what, as far as we know, they are, because London Fields were contract brewing at a brewery in Lincolnshire called Tom Woods, which itself has gone into administration.
Yeah.
But according to Brooklyn's statement, they will cease production and then build a brewery in London within the space.
Yeah.
And then start brewing again in a few months, sounds like. And I imagine with the money behind it, there'll be decent brewery. They'll be able to pay staff well, so they'll pull in some good brewers.
Yeah, it's a great place to be in London. You know, it's right there in the heart of where interesting things are happening in East London. Yeah, and I think another point to make about London Fields is, although it has a bad reputation and although, you know, lots of people don't feel great about London Fields, it has produced a huge number of people who've been influential in London beer.
Yeah. You know, some of them, like the guys who started Mondo Brewery, they were all ex-London Fields. Mondo's great brewery. It doesn't get talked about enough.
Yeah. Or Ben Ott, you know, at 40 Foot.
Yeah.
You know, he went from there to Truman's and 40 Foot, a fantastic brewer.
Yeah.
So there's loads of people who've gone through London Fields and it has had a huge positive influence, albeit less directly.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's put a lot of people into the beer industry and they're still in the industry, which is a huge positive.
Yeah.
So coming back to, I was just talking about, you know, Brooklyn Lager being on tap everywhere. Sierra Nevada's on tap everywhere.
Yeah.
Brooklyn is just 2 years running hosted a large beer festival in the middle of East London. We've also got Goose Island, who run two large beer festivals in London a year, and they've got their own bar. We've got Lagunitas. We've just heard they're going to build a brewery in Manchester. There's talk, there's rumours, and I will stress that these are like early rumours. The rumours are that Firestone Walker are looking to put a bar in London. Mm. Is this the American invasion? What risk does this pose to British brewers, and in particular London brewers, because their focus is so London-centric?
It's a really interesting question, you know, and it will come down to what matters in the end. Because if you're an American brewer like Lagunitas and you're brewing the beer in Manchester to the same standards you brew it in the States and producing that kind of beer that people want, and you're able to keep costs down, to keep prices down, so you're undercutting smaller local brewers. You know, will people remain loyal to their local brewery? You know, and that is the question. I think for most people, it probably won't matter. And I think you know, there is a risk to the smaller, newer British breweries from what's happening. You know, I think the American brewers have realised that Britain is a growing market, you know, and it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, and much bigger than some of the other markets they tend to export into. Obviously, Canada's one, Scandinavia.
Yeah.
You know, but Britain could potentially be bigger than those. So, I think it is a risk to some of the British brewers. It'll be very interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. Cool. So where does the London beer scene go from here? What's next for London beer?
I think a continuing focus on driving up standards in terms of the quality of the beer that's served to customers. I think breweries, a lot of breweries are really good on that now. I think still there are issues in terms of pubs and bars, in terms of service, in terms of how beer is looked after, in terms of the equipment that's installed in a lot of pubs. You know, and those are issues that will take a number of years to sort out. So I think that's the issue. I think there are still parts of London which are not great for beer. You know, Northwest London, you can...
Northwest and West, so that's sort of like sort of just past Camden bit, and then
if you cut London down the middle, and I always say this, and I think it's still true, you know, on the east side of that line, there's loads of amazing, exciting food, coffee, beer, whatever.
Yeah.
On the west side of the line, there's some nice stuff, but it's more isolated and it's less common.
Yeah.
And there's lots of factors for that. I think people in West London tend to be richer. I think there are other factors at play.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we start to see that division break down, that would be a good thing for everyone.
Fantastic. And how does London present itself so that do you think the rest of the UK will always look at it with a bit of a side eye? Or do you think there's a way of bringing those people into the fold and helping them see London beer as Londoners do?
I think there's resentment about the focus there is on London beer, and I understand that because the media and, you know, it is based here and it reflects that.
Pretty much like most of the sort of prominent beer writers in the UK are, you know, based in London. There's ourselves, there's Mark Dredge, Melissa Cole, Pete Brown.
Yeah, absolutely.
All Londoners.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, from London's point of view, is it's a great place for beer from all over the country, for brewers from all over the country to send their beer and to sell their beer.
Yeah.
And London beer equally can go elsewhere. I think there will always be a resentment about London just because it is London and so much power is centralised in London.
Yeah.
You know, and there would have to be structural changes beyond the world of beer that would have to take place before that change. So, yes, there will always be resentment against London. I think sometimes it's justified and sometimes, you know, it should be taken with a pinch of salt.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, folks. It's conversations like this that remind me just how great a beer city my hometown of London is. This week we published a stunning look at the Westmalle Trappist Brewery in Belgium from Brendan Kearney. Our Fervent Few members dug into the topic of craft as its own category within the beer sector. And finally, we saw the return of our hunter-gatherer section, with GBH founder Michael Kaiser recounting a tale from his recent trip to New Orleans with our editorial director, Austin Ray. Thanks to the members of the Fervent Few whose subscriptions directly fund GBH's content. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine. If you want to join, visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/goodbeerhunting, or click on the link in our show notes. And thanks to Guinness for their underwriting contributions. If you'd like to inquire about underwriting support for GBH, get in touch via the website or email underwriting@goodbeerhunting.com. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, pour liberal, folks. Have a great week.